I walk into my bedroom and strip off my dress, replacing it with the oversized t-shirt I sleep in. Then I duck into the bathroom to remove my makeup and brush my teeth. It's only 10 o'clock, but that scene with Tony left me drained. So I shut off the light and climb into bed. It's a long time before Reed comes to my room, an hour at least, which tells me that he and Easton must have had a really long talk.
You had my brother's back tonight.
His husky voice finds me in the darkness, and the mattress shifts as he slides in next to me. I don't resist when he wraps his strong arms around me and rolls me over so that my head is resting on his bare chest.
Thank you, he says,
and he sounds so touched that I shift in discomfort. I just paid off his debt, no big deal, I answer, downplaying my role in tonight's events.
Fuck that. It is a big deal.
He strokes the small of my back.
Easton told me about the money in your car. You didn't have to give it to that bookie, but I'm so grateful that you did. I tore Easton a new asshole tonight for getting involved with that guy. His other bookie is legit, but Loreno is bad news.
Hopefully he stops using bookies altogether after tonight. I'm not convinced he will, though. Easton feeds off the thrill he gets from gambling, or drinking, or screwing everyone he can. That's just who he is. Reed tugs me on top of him, and we both laugh when the sheets get tangled up in our legs. He kicks them away, then brings my head down and kisses me. He strokes me over my shirt as his tongue chases mine into my mouth. And then he says,
"Are you pissed that I threw down with that creep tonight?"
I'm too distracted by his wandering hands to understand the question. "You beat up Tony?"
"No, that dickweed Scott."
Reed's features harden.
"Nobody's allowed to talk to you like that. I won't let them."
Reed Royal, my very own dragon slayer. I smile and bend down to kiss him again. Maybe this says something about me, but I think it's hot when you go all caveman on me. He grins.
"Just say the word and I'll knock you over the head with a club and drag you into a cave."
I burst out laughing. "Oh, that's so romantic."
"Never said I was good at romance."
His voice thickens.
"I'm good at other things, though."
He totally is. We stop talking as our lips meet again, and then we lie there kissing, while his hands run up and down my body. When his finger slides inside me, I forget all about the club and the bookie and Easton's plea for me never to leave. Hell, I forget my name. Reed is the only thing that exists. Right here. Right now. He's the center of my universe. The weekend passes quickly. Callum comes home on Saturday morning, so Reed and I are forced to sneak off to fool around in the pool house. And on Saturday night, Valerie and I go out for dinner, and I finally cave and tell her about all the dirty things I do with Reed Royal. She's thrilled about it, but points out that we're still not doing the dirtiest thing of all, and proceeds to tease me about being a prude. But I don't mind the slow pace Reed has set. A part of me is ready to cross that final hurdle, but he keeps holding back, almost as if he's afraid to go there. I don't know why he would be, considering we're getting each other off on a daily basis in other ways. On Monday, Reed drives me to work, and to my dismay, the school day flies by. Today is the will reading, but no matter how hard I beg my watch to tick slower, the final bell rings before I'm ready, and then I'm walking down the front steps toward the waiting town car. Callum doesn't say much as Durand drives us into the city, but when we reach the gleaming building that houses the law offices of Greer, Gray, and Devereaux, he turns to me with an encouraging smile.
"It might get rough in there," he warns, "but just know that Dinah is all bark and no bite, for the most part anyway."
I haven't seen Steve's widow since our first meeting at her penthouse, and I'm not looking forward to the reunion. Neither is she, apparently, because she sneers the moment Callum and I enter the fancy office. I'm introduced to four lawyers and ushered to a comfortable sofa. Callum is about to sit beside me when one of the lawyers shifts his body and a familiar figure steps out from behind it.
"What are you doing here?" Callum snaps. I specifically ordered you not to come.
Brooke is unfazed by his tone. I'm here to support my best friend. Dinah steps up beside her, and the two women link arms. They could be sisters, with their long blonde hair and delicate features. I suddenly realize I don't know anything about their history, and I probably should have asked Callum about it a long time ago, because obviously, the two of them are super tight. If we're choosing sides, then I guess Brooke and I are occupying opposite corners. My loyalties are with the royals. By the disdain in Brooke's eyes, she knows it. I guess she thought I'd be with her. That she, Dinah, and I would team up against the evil royal males, and now I'm betraying them.
I asked her to come, Dinah says coldly. Now let's get started. We have early dinner reservations at Pierre's.
We're about to sit down to hear her dead husband's will, and she's worrying about missing her dinner reservations? This woman is really something. Another man separates himself from the group.
I'm James Dake, Mrs. O'Halloran's attorney.
He offers his hand to Callum, who looks at the hand, and then at Dinah in disbelief. I'm not familiar with this sort of thing, but it's easy to see that Callum is confused and unhappy about Dinah bringing both Brooke and another lawyer. Callum reluctantly lowers himself on the couch, while Brooke and Dinah sit on the one opposite us. The lawyers seat themselves in various chairs, while the one behind the desk, the Greer of Greer, Gray, and Devereaux, shuffles some papers and clears his throat.
This is the last will and testament of Stephen George O'Halloran, he begins.
The gray-haired lawyer spits out a bunch of legal gibberish about bequests to various people I've never heard of, money left in trust to a few charities, and something called a life estate being granted to Dinah. Dinah's lawyer frowns at this, so it must not be good for Dinah. There are also substantial gifts to Callum's boys, in case, and the lawyer coughs before he recites the line,
Callum has pissed away his fortune on booze and blondes before I kick off.
Callum merely smiles.
And to any legal issue surviving my death, I leave.
I'm too busy trying to figure out what legal issue means to focus on the rest of Greer's sentence. So I jolt in surprise when Dinah lets out an outraged screech.
What? No, I will not stand for this.
I lean in to Callum for an explanation of what the lawyer said, and I'm stunned by his answer. Apparently, I'm the legal issue. Steve left me half of his fortune, somewhere to the tune of... I feel faint when Callum tells me the number. Holy crap. The father I never even met didn't leave me millions. He didn't leave me tens of millions. He left me hundreds of millions. I'm gonna pass out, I really am.
And a fourth of the company, Callum adds. The shares will be transferred into your name when you're 21.
Across the room, Dinah shoots to her feet, wobbling on her impossibly high heels, as she swings around to glare at the lawyers.
He was my husband. Everything he had is mine, and I refuse to share it with this gutter brat who might not even be his child.
The DNA testing, Callum starts angrily.
Your DNA testing, she shoots back. And we all know the lengths you'll go to when it comes to protecting your precious Steve.
She spins toward the lawyers again.
I demand another test, one that's conducted by my people.
Greer nods.
We would be happy to accommodate that request. Your husband left several DNA samples that are being stored at a private lab in Raleigh. I took care of the paperwork myself.
Dinah's lawyer speaks up reassuringly.
We'll get a sample of comparison from Miss Harper before we leave. I can supervise the process.
The adults keep talking and bickering among themselves, while I sit there in stunned silence. My mind keeps tripping over the words, hundreds of millions. It's more money than I could have ever dreamed of. And part of me feels guilty for inheriting it. I didn't know Steve. I don't deserve half of his money. Callum notices my stricken face and squeezes my hand, while Brooke's lips curl in distaste. I ignore the waves of hostility rolling toward me and concentrate on drawing air in and out of my lungs. I didn't know Steve. He didn't know me. But as I sit here, battling my shock, I suddenly realize that he loved me, or at least, he'd wanted to love me. And my heart aches that I never got the chance to love him back. Chapter 34. Hours after the will reading, I'm still numb, still shocked, still sad. I don't know what to do with the ball of pain in my stomach, so I just curl up on my bed and let my mind go blank. I don't let myself think about Steve O'Halloran and how I'll never ever know him, really know him. I don't think about Dinah's threats as Callum and I were leaving the law office, or the angry words Brooke hurled at Callum when he refused to take her to dinner so they could, quote-unquote, talk. I guess she wants him back. I'm not surprised. Eventually, Reed walks into my room. He locks the door, then joins me on the bed and pulls me into his arms.
Dad said to give you space, so I gave you 2 hours. But that's over now. Talk to me, babe.
I bury my face in his neck. I don't feel like talking.
What happened with the lawyers? Dad wouldn't say anything.
He's determined to make me talk, damn it. Groaning, I sit up and meet his concerned eyes. I'm a multimillionaire, I blurt out. Not just a regular old millionaire, but a multi-millionaire. I'm freaking out right now. His lips twitch. I'm serious. What the hell am I gonna do with that kind of money? I wail.
Invest it? Give it to charity? Spend it?
Reed pulls me toward him again.
You can do whatever you want.
I don't deserve it. The meek response slips out before I can stop it, and the next thing I know, all my emotions rush to the surface. I tell him about the will reading, and Dinah's reaction, and my realization that Steve actually considered me his daughter, even though he never knew me. Reed doesn't comment, not once during my long-winded speech, and I realize that's what I wanted from him. I don't need advice or reassurances. I just need someone to listen. When I finally go quiet, he does something even better. He kisses me, long and deep, and the strength of his body pressed against mine eases the anxiety in my chest. His lips travel along my neck, the line of my jaw, my cheeks. Every kiss makes me fall harder and harder for him. It's a terrifying feeling, and it lodges in my throat and triggers the urge to run. I've never loved anyone before. I loved my mom, but it's not the same thing. What I'm feeling right now is all-consuming. It's hot and achy and powerful, and it's everywhere, overflowing in my heart, pulsing through my blood. Reed Royal is inside me, figuratively, but oh God, I need it to be literally too. I need him, and I'm going to have him, and my hands are frantic as they claw at his zipper.
Ella.
He groans, intercepting my hands.
No.
Yes, I whisper into his lips. I want this.
Callum's home.
The reminder is like a splash of cold water to the face. His dad could knock on my door at any second, and probably will, because I know Callum sensed how upset I was when we got home. I curse in frustration. You're right, we can't. Reed kisses me again, just the soft brush of his lips. Before he slides off the bed.
Are you gonna be okay? Easton and I were supposed to go out for beers with some of the guys from the team tonight, but I can cancel if you need me to stick around.
No, it's fine. Go. I'm still digesting this money thing, and I probably won't be good company tonight.
I'll be back in a couple hours,
he promises.
We can watch a movie or something, if you're still up.
After he's gone, I curl up again and end up falling asleep for 2 hours. Which is totally gonna mess up my sleep schedule. I wake up when my cell phone rings, and I'm startled to see Gideon's number on the screen. I have all the brothers' numbers, but this is the first time Gideon has ever called me. I answer the phone, still a bit groggy. Hey, what's up?
You home?
Is his terse reply. I'm on guard almost immediately. It's just two words, but I hear something in his voice that scares me. He's angry. Yeah, why?
I'm 5 minutes away.
He is? On a Monday? Gideon never comes home from college during the week.
Can we go for a drive? I need to talk to you.
My brows knit together. Why can't we talk here?
Because I don't want anyone overhearing us.
I sit up in bed, but I'm still not comfortable with his request. Not that I think he's gonna murder me on the side of the road or anything, but asking me to go for a drive is strange, especially for Gideon.
It's about Savannah, okay? He mutters. And I want it to stay between you and me.
I relax slightly, but the confusion lingers. This is the first time Gideon has mentioned Savannah to me. I only know about their history because of Easton. Still, I can't deny I'm insanely curious about it. I'll meet you outside, I tell him. His huge SUV waits in the driveway when I descend the front steps. I hop into the passenger seat, and Gideon drives off without a word. His profile is like stone, and his shoulders rigid. And he doesn't say a single word until he pulls into a small plaza, 5 minutes later, and kills the engine.
Are you having sex with Reed?
My mouth falls open, and my heart starts pounding, because the furious look in his eyes is unexpected. No, I stammer. It's the truth.
But you're together, Gideon presses. You're hooking up?
Why are you asking me this?
I'm trying to figure out how much damage control I'm gonna have to do.
Damage control? What the hell is he talking about? Shouldn't we be talking about Savannah? I ask uneasily.
This is about Savannah, and you, and Reed.
His breathing sounds labored.
Whatever you're doing, you need to stop. Right now, Ella, you need to end it.
My pulse is even more off-kilter. Why?
Because no good will come of it.
He drags a hand through his hair, which causes his head to tilt back a bit, drawing my attention to the red mark on his neck. It looks like a hickey.
Reed is screwed up, Gideon says hoarsely. He's as screwed up as I am, and look, you're a nice girl. There are other guys at Astor. Reed'll be off to college soon.
Gideon's words tumble out, a bunch of disjointed sentences that I can't make sense out of. I know Reed's screwed up, I start to say.
You have no clue, no clue at all, he interrupts. Reed and I and my dad, we have one thing in common. We ruin women's lives. We drive women to the cliff and then push them over. You're a decent person, Ella, but if you stay here and continue with Reed, I...
He breaks off, his breathing heavy. You what? His knuckles whiten as he grips the steering wheel tighter, but offers no other explanation.
You what, Gideon? You need to stop asking questions and start listening, Gideon snaps. End it with my brother. You can be his friend, like you are with Easton and the twins. Don't start up a relationship with him.
Why not?
God damn it, are you always this fucking difficult? I'm trying to save you from getting your heart broken and offing yourself with a bottle of pills.
He finally explodes. Oh. His outburst makes sense now. His mother killed herself. Oh, God. Did Savannah try something, too? Reed and I have things sorted out, but I don't think Gideon is ready to hear that. And I suspect he isn't going to let up until I agree to his crazy demands. Well, fine. I'll agree then. Reed and I are already sneaking around behind Callum's back. It'll be easy enough to hide it from Gideon, too. Okay. I reach out and rest a soothing hand on his. I'll end it with Reed. You're right. We're messing around, but it's not serious or anything. I lie. He runs a hand through his hair again.
You sure about that?
I nod. Reed won't care. And honestly, if it upsets you this much, I'm sure he'll agree that it's not worth it. I squeeze Gideon's hand. Chill, okay? I don't want to ruin the dynamic we have going on in the house. I'm cool about ending it. Gideon relaxes, his breath coming out in a long rush.
Okay, good.
I take my hand back. Can we go home now? If someone drives by and sees us parked here, the rumor mill at school is gonna explode tomorrow. He chuckles weakly.
Truth.
I fix my gaze out the window as he starts the engine and pulls out of the parking lot. We don't talk on the ride back, and he doesn't get out of the car when he drops me off. You heading back to school now? I ask.
Yeah.
He speeds off, and for some reason I don't believe that he's returning to college. At least not tonight. I'm also more than a little freaked out by his outburst, and his insane request for me to stay away from Reed. Speaking of Reed, his Rover is parked near the garage, and the sight fills me with relief. He's back. And all the other vehicles are gone, even the town car, which means Reed and I will be alone. I hurry inside and take the stairs two at a time. At the landing, I veer right toward the east wing, where every door is open except for Reed's. The twins and Easton are nowhere to be seen, and my bedroom is empty too when I peek in. I haven't been in Reed's bedroom before. He always hangs out in mine. But tonight, I'm not going to wait for him to come to me. Gideon really shook me up, and Reed is the only one who can help me make sense of his brother's strange behavior. I reach his door and lift my hand to knock, then smile ruefully because God knows no one in this house ever knocks on my door. They just waltz in like they belong in my room. So I decide to give Reed a taste of his own medicine. Childish as it is, I kind of hope he's jerking off in there, just to teach him a lesson about the importance of knocking. I throw open the door and say, "Reed, I..." The words die in my throat. I stumble to a stop and gasp. Chapter 35. The clothes litter the floor like an obscene breadcrumb trail. I follow the path with my eyes. High-heeled shoes tipped over on their sides. Running shoes bracketing them. A shirt. A dress. Under. I close my eyes as if I can erase the images, but when I open them again, it's unchanged. Lacy black things, things I would never wear, look as if they were dropped just before their owner climbed into bed. My gaze flickers upward, past strong calves, over knees, beyond a pair of hands loosely clasped together, up the ladder of his bare ridged abdomen, pausing at a new scratch on his left pectoral, about where his heart is supposed to be, stopping to meet his gaze. "Where's Easton?" I blurt out. My mind rejects the scene. I superimpose a different story than the one laid out in front of me, a story where I've stumbled into Easton's room, and Reed, in a booze-induced haze, stumbled into the wrong room too. But Reed just stares stonily back at me, daring me to question his actions. "There's no way that Reed is going without," I hear Val whisper in my ear. "The guys you were meeting for beers?" I toss out desperately. I give Reed every chance to spin an account different than the one I see before me. "Lie to me, damn it!" But he remains stubbornly silent. Brooke rises like a ghostly specter from behind him, and the earth stops. Time stretches out as she slides her hand up Reed's spine, over his shoulder, and then brings her manicured fingers across his chest. There's no question she's naked. She kisses Reed's neck, all the while looking at me, and he doesn't move. Not one muscle. "Reed." His name is no more than a whisper, a painful scratch against my throat.
"Your desperation is sad."
Brooke's voice sounds wrong in this room. "You should leave. Unless..." She stretches out a bare leg and drapes it outside of Reed's hips, which are still covered in the cotton of his sweatpants.
"Unless you want to watch."
The pain in my throat gets worse as she remains wrapped around him, and he makes no effort to move away. Her hand drifts down his arm, and when it reaches his wrist, he moves, a tiny, almost imperceptible flinch. I watch with alarm as her fingers glide across his abs, and before she can take hold of what I'd started to believe belonged to me, I turn abruptly and leave. I had been wrong. Wrong about so many things that my mind can't catalog them all. When we were moving around so often, I thought I needed roots. When Mom had her umpteenth boyfriend who leered at me too long, I wondered if I needed a father figure. When I was alone at night and she was working long, tiring hours waiting tables, stripping, and God knows what else to keep me fed and clothed. I longed for siblings. When she was sick, I prayed for money. And now I have all of that, and I am worse off than before. I run to my bedroom and stuff my backpack full of my makeup, my 2 pairs of skinny jeans, 5 t-shirts, underwear, stripper gear for Miss Candy's, and my mother's dress. I keep the tears at bay, because crying isn't going to get me out of this nightmare, only putting 1 foot in front of the other. The house is deathly silent. The echoes of Brooke's laughter, when I told her that there was one good and decent man out there, bounces from one side of my skull to the other. My imagination conjures up visions of Brooke and Reed, his mouth on her, his fingers touching her. Outside the house, I stumble to the corner and vomit. Acid coats my mouth, but I push on. The car starts immediately. I shove it into gear and, with shaking hands, navigate down the driveway. I keep waiting for that movie moment when Reed runs out of the house screaming for me to come back. But it never happens. There's no rain-filled reunion, and the only moisture are the tears. I can't hold back any longer. The monotone voice of the GPS directs me to my destination. I shut off the engine, pull out the title to the car, and shove it in my Auden book. Auden wrote that, when the boy falls from the sky, after calamity, he still has a future somewhere, and that there's no point in dwelling on one's loss. But did he suffer this? Would he have written that if he had lived my life? I rest my head on the steering wheel. My shoulders shake from my sobs and my stomach heaves again. I lurch out of the car and stagger on shaky legs to the entrance of the bus station.
"You all right, honey?"
the ticket counter attendant asks, looking worried. Her kindness wrenches another sob from me.
My grandmother passed,
I lie.
"Oh, I'm so sorry. Funeral, then?"
I jerk my head in a nod. She types into her computer, the long nails clicking against the keyboard.
"Round trip?"
"No, one way. I don't think I'm coming back." Her hands pause above the keys.
"Are you sure? It's cheaper to buy a round trip ticket."
"There's nothing here for me." "Nothing," I repeat. I think it's the anguish in my eyes that gets her to stop asking questions. She silently prints out the ticket. I take it and climb into the bus that cannot take me far enough and fast enough from this place. Reed Royal has broken me. I've fallen from the sky, and I'm not sure I can get up. Not this time.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Paper Princess, written by Aaron Watt. Performed by Angela Goethals. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016, Aaron Watt. Production copyright 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc. If you enjoyed this audiobook, be sure to get more books in the Royals series today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.